Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is back in Arizona today. He's rallying supporters this hour in Prescott Valley. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn is outside the Prescott Valley Event Center, and she joins me. And Casey, first off, can you describe the scene there?
Yeah, sure, Mark. It's crowded. There are so many people here. So many people have driven up from Phoenix. I met some ladies all the way from Scottsdale who decided to make it a day and come out here and support their candidate for President Trump. There's flags everywhere, a lot of merchandise, sellers. There's one area for protesters to stand in. It's about an acre wide. It's fenced off. Some people were talking back and forth about race issues, about whether or not how Trump believes, what his beliefs are. Other than that, it's a pretty calm crowd. Just everyone's ready to get in.
So, Casey, the protesters are, it sounds like they're being kept in a particular area. Are they having a lot of interaction with Trump supporters, either just in general or as they're going into the arena?
Yeah, I mean, they're not right next to where the line is, but people are meandering over. Some of the Trump supporters are meandering over. When I was over there, there were about 10 people. Now it looks like there's about 15, 20 people with signs, you know, one person dressed up as a clown with a Trump mask on. Yeah, but people are talking back and forth about what they think Trump believes in. You know, the protesters are saying he's a racist. They're saying he doesn't like Muslims. Well, one man was an immigrant from a Muslim country and came here and says he's a Trump supporter and he doesn't think what they're saying is accurate.
And we obviously hear one of the songs that Trump's rallies have featured, the Rolling Stones, You Can't Always Get What You Want, behind you there. Casey, what are supporters of Donald Trump saying that they hope to hear from him today?
Well, a lot of supporters are looking forward to hearing him as a businessman. I met a man who was born in Prescott, owned a business, really believed in the way that Trump ran his business. Some other women were here from Scottsdale saying they really loved his family values. They're part of a Bible study, and they think that the family values he talks about how he raises his children are something that they really admire. So it sounds like a lot of that sort of looking forward to making America great again, as his slogan goes. They're all believing that he will talk exactly about how he will make America great again.
Casey, have you heard any concern from Trump supporters about either sort of how this past week has gone in the polls or how the reaction to his debate performance has been, or the fact that he is in Arizona with, you know, just over a month until the election, a reliably Republican state?
Well, they're really happy he's here. You know, it's a conservative area around here, Yavapai County. And I don't think that anyone's concerned. The only thing they're concerned about is that Hillary Clinton will become president rather than their candidate, Trump. Like I said, the business owner that I met and talked to from Prescott wasn't worried about his tax returns. He doesn't want Trump to release his tax returns because he says that people are just looking for something to nitpick, that, you know, in a month from now, it's too close to the election to have that happen.
That's KJZZ's Casey Kuhn outside the Donald Trump rally in Prescott Valley. Casey, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Arizona usually votes red, but this presidential race has become a bit of a toss-up. KJZZ's Laurel Morales joins me from Flagstaff to introduce us to one voter who can shed some light on how Native Americans may vote in Arizona. And Laurel, how powerful is the Native vote here?
So I spoke with Marley Lister. He's a young Navajo voter who has lived both on and off the reservation. And as you might already know, there are 22 federally recognized tribes in Arizona, including the largest in the country, the Navajo. American Indians only make up about 5% of the state's population, but they have been a swing vote in close races.
I've always been political. My grandfather was a chapter house president, but also a councilman in the Navajo Nation. And I used to play when they were at the chapter house meetings. Looking back at it now, I'm like, oh, wow, maybe that's like subconsciously I picked it up and I wanted to be part of it.
That's 22-year-old Marley Lister. He recently graduated from Arizona State University, and now he's a research assistant at the Diné Policy Institute, a research organization on the Navajo Nation. He wants to go into politics and maybe run for president one day, president of the Navajo Nation.
Well, Laurel, what would you say is the biggest issue facing voters on the Navajo Nation right now?
Well, right now, 40% lack access to clean drinking water. Many drive for miles to get clean water. Another big issue is the unemployment rate. 50% are unemployed. Marley is one of the lucky ones to have a job on the reservation, but many people leave.
We're always told to come back, get an education and come back. There's like that nag. Not, it's more of a pull that it's like, I need to go back and do something. The reality, though, is that there's no jobs to really come back to. There's like what's considered a brain drain.
On the day I met Marley, he was chopping wood for his grandmother, Mary Key, on the east side of the Grand Canyon in a juniper forest on Navajo land. She's a Navajo elder who's been following the election closely.
No.
Are you planning to vote?
Yes, I'll vote all my life. For a Democrat. For the Democrat.
She knows. She was like, make sure she doesn't get too close to the act.
Laurel, why were they chopping wood?
So Mary Key, the matriarch of the family, she just got solar power last year, but she still relies on a wood stove to heat her home. And they were chopping wood. They were filling about 2 truckloads with wood. That will last her about a month. And she's like many other people on the Navajo Nation, 15,000 other people, that's about 11%, still live without electricity. Marley takes a break to talk with me. Almost the entire family has left the reservation to find work. Marley and his brother were raised on and off the reservation by their single mom. In high school, Marley preferred living in Phoenix.
I really like electricity. You know, I like, you know, having hot water or watching TV.
Marley says the candidates rarely talk about Native American issues publicly, like water scarcity or energy. Both Clinton and Trump have met with Navajo leaders. Right before the primary, Bernie Sanders held a rally on the Navajo Nation. He's said to be the first presidential candidate to do so. That won over Marley and a lot of his peers.
A lot of Navajo youth called him Che Bernie, which means Grandpa Bernie. So I was at that rally in Phoenix.
Now that Sanders isn't a contender, Marley sees Hillary Clinton going after those votes.
Hillary, she flip-flops. It seems like she's just doing it to get votes. As Secretary of State, she was very pro-fracking. But then as she won against Bernie, she took it mainly to try to get Bernie supporters, which is, look, I'm not fracking anymore. It makes me nervous. If I'm going to vote for someone, I want them to be very, very solid on their positions.
Marley hopes that Clinton will take a stand on the issues important to him, like the environment, water, jobs, tribal sovereignty, and women's rights. He says he won't vote for Trump, and he doesn't know anyone on or off the Navajo Nation who will.
That's KJZZ's Laurel Morales in Flagstaff. Thanks, Laurel.
You're welcome, Mark.
And the number of minority millennials eligible to vote this election is growing across both Arizona and the Valley. KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block spoke with one voter in Mesa who calls herself a reluctant Clinton supporter.
Xenia Arona is 24 and lives on a quiet street in Mesa in a rented house.
We're going to be moving out soon and eventually end up buying a house, but we're not quite there yet.
Arona shares this place with her husband, 2 pit bulls, and 2 roommates to save on rent. She's part of a growing group of potential voters in Arizona, Latino millennials. Her mother's a citizen who grew up on both sides of the border, and her father immigrated from Mexico.
I care a lot about LGBTQ rights. I'm against police brutality, and I care more about holding our police accountable. I care about immigration, of course, because it's a big part of my life.
Not only is Arona the daughter of an immigrant, she's also married to one. And her job is to assist Central American migrant children. One of her biggest priorities is a pathway to citizenship for immigrants here without papers. But that's not it.
I care about being able to go to school and not break the bank. That's something that I'm struggling with right now for myself. I want to go back to school, but it's just so much debt, so expensive.
Arona got her bachelor's degree from Arizona State University a few years ago. During the primary, she was so passionate about Bernie Sanders, she volunteered for him. When Hillary Clinton became the Democratic candidate, Arona backed her, but she says reluctantly. She tuned into the first debate between Clinton and Donald Trump last week.
I was kind of cynical about the whole thing. But once it got going, the first question right out of the gate, she had policy proposals and she was very legitimate. She felt like a president.
Arona says Clinton's proposals for investing in the middle class and education made her feel enthusiastic.
I'm not going to go out and volunteer for her campaign or anything, but I am going to open up the conversation and try to convince as many people as I can.
I asked her why she was willing to volunteer for Sanders, but not for Clinton.
She's a negotiator, and she is able to make compromises, which is good and bad. I feel like she doesn't have all of my interests in heart.
Arona's demographic, young Latinos, have not turned out in high numbers in the past. But Arona believes in voting, since she has family members who can't. She has an aunt who doesn't have papers, her father's a legal permanent resident, and her husband was born in Mexico and grew up in Phoenix as a so-called dreamer.
Since they live here, but they don't necessarily have a voice, it's important for me to be able to use that power that I do have.
Now, with the vice presidential debate coming up, Arona will be watching. She likes that Clinton's running mate Tim Kaine has made an effort to learn Spanish, but she also wishes Clinton had chosen someone more progressive and Latino.
It would have also been a smart choice to appeal to people like me.
But the Clinton-Kaine ticket seems to have snagged Arona's vote anyway. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The First Baptist Church on Monroe Street in downtown Phoenix was built in 1929, but in 1984, a fire burned much of it to the ground. Back then, Terry Goddard was mayor of Phoenix, and he kept what was left of the church from being bulldozed. Today, decades later, he's still working to keep the historic building alive, and now he's finally starting to see the end of the road. Goddard gave the show's Lauren Gilger a tour of the building this morning, and she joins me. And Lauren, what's next for this church?
So Goddard says it could be transformed into restaurants, galleries, coffee shops, maybe even a theater. And that's because his nonprofit, which is renovating the building, raised the money recently to reinforce the entire structure so it can be used. So when he showed me around this morning, I could see a lot of that concrete and steel reinforcement, and there were a lot of pigeons too. And Goddard says that's because the city required almost an entire restructuring of the building.
What the city required us to do was to build a complete steel building inside the old brick building. You'll see a lot of additional steel to make sure that it's solid. If there was ever an earthquake in Phoenix, this would be the place to be.
So, I mean, this is a massive space. We just walked into sort of the center of where the church was, and this is huge.
This was the sanctuary. This, where we're standing, is going to be a courtyard, obviously, in the future because it lost its roof in the fire. But this was inside and sat, I'm told, 1,500 people at a full service. It also had this magnificent full stage. It's a very elegant stage. It has, as you can see, columns on both sides. It had a proscenium arch, although that was lost in the fire. It had terrific lighting, both from the top and along the sides. It had a double curtain. You can see two slashes here in the wall, which shows that it had a theatrical curtain. So very wide, very deep stage, and we hope to be able to bring that back for performances of all kinds. We're looking at the Rose Window, which is extraordinary. That's one of the things that we prize the most, but also the Spanish-style bell tower with its red tile roof, and one of my dreams is to get real bells into that tower someday.
Right, so this was a massive amount of work just to get this place to code so that you could develop it.
Well, yes, and one of the issues, I think, for any kind of next step is people want to know what they're getting. You're not going to want to open a restaurant or a bar or a gallery here unless you know for sure that the walls are going to stand up. We felt that before we could credibly go out and talk to people about using the space, we had to do the fundamental reconstruction, and that's been done. So we're at a second stage, which is to bring in fact, today, we're bringing in a number of contractors to see what it would cost to take the next step.
So now you're at the point, like you said, where you're talking to developers. You want to figure out what's going to go here. What are your hopes for this place?
Well, my hopes, for example, this space, I think, would make a dynamic restaurant. We think that obviously the center courtyard could be used for a variety of entertainment and public events. The far side, the big assembly room, I think could be a black box theater. It could also be a major place for dining and meeting and community events. Want to see quickly upstairs?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's go upstairs.
These are the new stairs. You couldn't have done this 6 months ago. The second floor, the first floor, and the third floor are pretty much the same. The new thing about this floor is it's right under the rose window.
Oh, wow.
The rose window up close and personal. It's a massive piece of ornamented cast concrete. It's perfectly gorgeous. In the old days, it had glass in it. Obviously, the fire took care of that and melted the glass, but it still has a lot of elegance.
So I know that you were mayor at the time, but I sort of wonder, I mean, this is 20 years later since this fire. Like, what about this place makes you want to keep working with it and keep going?
A lot of things, but A, I think it's a wonderful building. It's a piece of Phoenix history, which it would have been all too easy after the fire to just bulldoze it and be done with it and have another parking lot downtown. I felt that the resonance of these walls was significant, and it was part of our history and something that people would treasure in the future if we could only hold on to it. So I feel my job has been over the past 25 years to make sure that nothing worse happened to it, and then hopefully now we're at the stage where we can make things much better.
All right, well, Terry Goddard, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Arizona's Early Literacy Initiative has come out with new maps showing how schools and districts fare in several key factors dealing with reading. The MapLit tool from Read On Arizona aims to help figure out what's working and what isn't, and to help students who need it. State law requires Arizona third graders to be reading at grade level before moving to fourth grade. With me to explain the new maps is Terry Clark, Arizona's Literacy Director. And Terry, what was the goal of putting all this data together and then releasing it?
Well, the goal behind MapLit really was about making data easy and accessible and digestible for users that were really trying to not just understand where we're at and what we're doing, sort of that temperature read that we often go to, but what could we know that would drive decisions and help develop strategies.
I think stereotypically when we think of schools, and especially elementary schools, that are succeeding and some that are maybe behind, there are certain types of schools that we think of as either doing well or not doing well. Is that sort of borne out by the data that you found and that you've put together with this MapLit program?
Well, it's a great question. And what was really, ASU did a fantastic sort of factors analysis on all the data that we had in MapLit. And three things came up to the top as causing kids to be behind in reading. One is poverty. So where they live and where they go to school matters. The other is attendance, so time on task. And then third is that there is some reason that some charter schools are doing better with our struggling readers and our third grade readers.
When you talk about something like attendance, that seems like a fairly inexpensive fix, but I would imagine it's not an easy thing to do, to get kids to school who are not at school and to get parents to make sure that their kids are at school if they're not already at school a lot.
That's exactly right. I mean, we have to understand what are the barriers. Why are kids not getting to school? And a lot of times we think it's because there's apathy or families don't care, but it's really usually not. It's usually health, so chronic asthma or dental.
Is it safe to say that that also sort of plays into the poverty issue as well?
I think so. I think our families are dealing with so many stressors that we really have to understand. It could be housing issues that are causing kids to miss school, transportation. It could be, again, like I said, health. There's a lot of factors. So the best thing we can do is to help understand and then support them in getting them connected to the social and community services that will help them overcome whatever the issue is.
It's been a few years now since the Move On When Reading law has been in effect in Arizona. How have you seen scores and grades and the number of students who are passing or not passing evolve over those years?
Well, I think in some grades we've seen some real shift and some leaps, and then in some grades and third grade we've seen a very incremental increase, and we want to see that accelerate. So that's why this focus on data, this focus on really understanding what the challenges are and then how early we have to start, that if we're just figuring this out by the time of students in third grade, it's almost too late.
Are those kinds of fixes legislative fixes? Are they things that you can do sort of absent government?
I think there's both. I think there's probably some policy issues that we're going to look at. And now that we've raised this issue up, I mean, until this project, we really didn't track chronic absenteeism. So now that we're tracking it, now that we're making that data accessible to anyone, you can find out what your chronic absenteeism rate is at your local school and by grade. So you can start to understand how to address it. And schools then are more prepared to be able to offer solutions.
When you were going through this data and putting this map together, were there things that surprised you, things that you didn't expect, either positive or negative?
There were a lot of things that were confirmed. You know, I don't think anybody was surprised that poverty is the biggest factor. And I think we knew that, but then digging under that and trying to figure out what the root cause and what are those stressors then in those families that are causing that. I think we saw nationally a trend about chronic absenteeism that this report confirmed for Arizona, that in our own backyard, this is an issue for us.
Yeah, does Arizona do better or worse than our neighboring states or other states across the country as far as the percentage of third graders who are reading at grade level?
We are not on the top of that list. We are sort of towards the bottom, but we've made increasing progress. So we, as opposed to other states, especially with our NAEP scores, have actually continued to make incremental progress. So we're headed in the right direction, where others have either sort of stayed status quo or slipped a bit.
Terry Clark is Arizona's literacy director. Terry, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Athletes have been known to try just about anything to help their performance, and now some are turning to the deep blue seas for hydration. Researchers at the University of Arizona have been studying the hydrating qualities of deep ocean water. Some products are already on store shelves here. John Kinhelis, an associate professor of physiology at the U of A, is one of them. And John, what is it about this deep ocean water that makes it appealing to use this way?
Well, when you look at what people typically use, you know, there are certain types of drinks that are touted more than others: mountain spring water, regular tap water, purified water, sort of carbohydrate, electrolyte-rich waters. This deep ocean water actually has a fairly long history, but yet, you know, in comparison to these others, it really hasn't been done to the extent that we've done it.
What is in this deep ocean water that maybe is not present in regular ocean water?
Well, that's a really great question. And, you know, when you look at the mineral content and everything else that's in there, this is pages and pages of different components. But in terms of the general, you know, electrolytes and minerals, it's not too unique in terms of how it compares in terms of the actual components. When you break it down, it's more the amounts and the ratios of these that may be different. You know, the origin really is from essentially, you know, melt off of glaciers, and you know, there's these geographically documented streams that are throughout the bottom of the ocean, and so happens that one hits this shelf drop off in off the coast of Kona, Hawaii, and so this group decided to tap into this and to study it. And so, you know, its content is different from other, let's say, deep ocean water sources in that it comes directly from these glacial streams.
So does that mean that maybe somebody would be able to drink less of it and get the same kind of benefit as from drinking like a bottle of mountain spring water or, you know, a glass of tap water, something like that?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't really have an answer to that. I think that, you know, one of the things that's limiting, of course, is volume. If you have to drink, you know, so much to sort of replenish what you've lost. So maybe, in fact, you know, that would be something you can sort of recover. I should note, though, that this water is, it's desalinated to a point where you don't remove all the mineral content or the electrolyte content. What you do is you make it essentially palatable so that you're not drinking literally a bucket of ocean water.
I wanted to ask you about the desalination question, because it seems like for a very long time, folks around the world, but also here, especially in the Southwest with the drought being in the desert, we've been looking at desalination as a possible solution to water issues here. Why is this an okay thing to do? Why is this like cost effective? How is it possible to do when cost especially has been considered a really big drawback for desalination on a big scale for, you know, for a city like Phoenix?
Yeah, again, that's a absolutely, you know, I think very valid and great question. You know, not being the marketing person and the business person that I am, I think actually that one of the advantages is that this is desalinated on site. So it really goes essentially from a sort of reverse osmosis process, and that it's done on site. So as soon as it comes up off the pipe, it's desalinated using this method, and then it goes right into the bottle. So in terms of, you know, how they do that cost effectively, I'm assuming it's based on just being all sort of on site. I think the other question actually that you sort of alluded to was this idea of renewability. You know, in terms of a renewable source of water, it seems as if, you know, this perhaps would be one of the most renewable sources, meaning that you're tapping into the largest body of water that's available.
What does this taste like?
You know, I think I'm probably the wrong person to ask, because my taste buds are very, very poor. Although, you know, I claim that, you know, I like good food, but you never know if I can't taste. There's a little bit of a greater smoothness to it, I guess. And maybe that's because it's a softer type of water. But it feels that as it's sort of going down, that it definitely has, you know, a little more ease to it.
John Kanhelis is an associate professor of physiology at the University of Arizona. John, thanks a lot.
Oh, no problem. It's been great talking to you.
Cesar Chavez and Chandler native Gustavo Gutierrez both fought to improve the lives of others. In the second part of our series on the farm worker movement in Arizona, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports on revolutionaries who followed a similar path that took them in different directions.
Raquel Gutierrez knew by the sixth grade that her father had a different job.
The teacher asked, "What do your parents do for a living?" I said, "My dad's a picketer." I had no idea what that meant, but what I did know is that he did things other parents didn't do.
Gustavo Gutierrez, or Gus, was a labor organizer and social activist. He called Cesar Chavez his mentor. Chavez led produce boycotts in the 1960s, and today he's honored by a commemorative holiday. Bands like Los Lobos have immortalized him in song. Viva la huelga, viva la unión. Like Chavez, Gus was born to a migrant farming family in Arizona. He didn't go to high school, but took it upon himself to learn. Gus met Chavez in the 60s and quickly joined the cause.
From the United Farm Workers, Arizona, Gus Gutierrez.
UFW had gained national momentum, and Gus spoke about empowering workers in a recording of a rally at the state capitol during that time.
And they can see that they can change the system in which they live. And I feel the same way that we can do it here in Arizona.
A right-to-work state for decades, Arizona wasn't union-friendly and eventually forced organizers like Chavez out of the state. The Maricopa County Organizing Project, or MCOP, emerged.
Gustavo was a key person always for us, and he was like the axis that brought us all together.
Tucson attorney Jesus Romo worked for MCOP, which in 1977 organized a successful strike of undocumented workers in Glendale. This is where Gus started to split from his mentor. Chavez saw illegal workers as weapons owners used to break unions. John Coughlin teaches history at Glendale Community College. He says Chavez wasn't always tolerant of the undocumented.
The language that he used sometimes to our modern ears is not a good one.
Ramona Gutierrez says her father's position conflicted with Chavez.
So my dad said, "You can't treat people like that. They're all the same, the ones who, they're all suffering the same, no matter whether they have papers, whether they don't."
The difference widened other cracks in the alliance. Here's Coughlin.
I think there was that conservative bent that Chavez organized the UFW in a very bureaucratic structure and didn't always allow for sort of local organizations to run their own affairs.
Jose Cortez worked with Chavez and Gus, who he says was sometimes called a communist.
Because he had a lot of socialist tendencies.
Cortez says the two labor groups stopped marching together shortly after the strike. Cortez chose to remain with Chavez's UFW, but grew closer to Gus after Chavez died in 1993.
I've always looked at Gustavo as an unsung hero because of the fact that he had a tremendous amount of love, just like Seth said, for the people, for the farm workers, for the downtrodden.
Ramona lives in her parents' Tempe home. She and two of her sisters spoke about their father over breakfast. The women grew up on boycotts.
Don't you feel a little awkward serving strawberries and grapes?
Gus made little money as an activist. Daughter Alejandra Gutierrez says they often wore hand-me-downs.
My dad would not have been able to do half the things that he did if it hadn't been for my mother.
Ricky was a registered nurse, carried the family financially, and let Gus chase his dreams. Daughter Raquel says he was a humanist.
My father told me when I was very young, you have to be able to get up and go to the fields at 4 a.m. in the morning and pick carrots with the workers and talk to them about their human rights. And you have to be able to go to the governor's office the same day at 4 p.m., sometimes in the same clothes.
After MCOP, Gus focused on Native American rights. He ended a 2012 speech at the state capitol with his mentor's phrase, "Si se puede," and died months later while on a journey to promote peace and dignity. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And Mariana Dale helped produce this story. The town of Ajo, south of Gila Bend and west of Tucson, is now the owner of 50 new bikes. They're part of a partnership between Pima County, the University of Arizona, and other groups. That project started more than a decade ago in three neighborhoods on Tucson's south side. Martha Monroy has been leading this effort. She's with the Mellon Edith Zuckerman College of Public Health at the U of A.
Ajo is a community that is, you know, at the far end of Pima County. The reservation is, you know, the Hudson Nation is in between Tucson and Ajo. And so it's often difficult to get, because of the distance, to get resources out there and expensive. And so we had a history of working through the college, of working with Desert Sinaitic Community Health Center. And so we thought, well, this would be a nice place to sort of replicate what we're doing here in another underserved community. Ajo also has very high rates of diabetes and chronic disease. And so we contacted the community to see if, you know, they would be interested in developing a cycling center there. And the response was incredibly positive.
In an effort to improve health in a town like Ajo, why bikes? Why not try to encourage people to get out and walk or run or something else that maybe is less expensive and requires less infrastructure?
That's funny, because I generally think about cycling, if you have access to a bike, as being a very cost-effective way of exercising. Walking, and we're certainly not excluding walking, it's just one other opportunity to get for physical activity. They have some really beautiful mountain bike trails out there. They've developed, actually they have a mountain bike map. And when you ask people what comes to mind when about bikes, and everybody, when you were a kid, and everybody said, you hear freedom and you hear, you know, adventure. And so you can use it not only for recreation, but also for transportation, right? So when you talk about Ajo being kind of far, and if folks don't have access to a car or can't get to the DMV to get their license, they certainly can get around on a bike.
Do you anticipate that people there will be using these bikes more for recreation or for, you know, getting to a job, getting to run errands, things like that, more practical purposes?
You know, it's going to be hard to predict. We had another group of our students, our MPH students, do a community assessment in Ajo around bikes and who had bikes and what were the barriers. You know, that's the hope for the cycling center right now. The community needs to decide how they want to sort of, how they want to let people take the bikes out.
How big of a dent do you think that this program could potentially put in some of the health problems that some of the residents of Ajo are experiencing?
Well, you know, this is something that I've learned from one of my mentors at the College of Public Health, and it really is true. You know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. These health disparities, these health inequities, these health issues didn't show up overnight, and it's going to take a while to address them. And so personally, I think the biggest impact will be with the kids. So at the very basic stage, it will be getting people out and getting exercise and improving folks' quality of life. And we're hoping that it will have an impact on preventing that next generation of getting diabetes or other chronic disease. And hopefully they'll be able to pull the adults in to not only prevent diabetes, but also to help folks manage their weight and health status.
Martha Monroy is with the Mel and Edith Zuckerman College of Public Health at the University of Arizona. We were talking about the school's partnership with other agencies to provide 50 bikes to the town of Ajo. If you like to write but sometimes get stuck or worry you're your own worst critic, you may go to a writing group for support. You get feedback and fresh ideas. Writing in the dark is no different, but all the writers there are blind or visually impaired. The show's Annika Klein went to this month's meeting.
The members of Writing in the Dark write about everything, from adventure to drama to happily ever afters. Often the group uses a prompt. For example, pick a song you love and draw inspiration from it. But this month, the prompt was about disability, in honor of National Disability Employment Awareness Month.
Sometimes you feel better when you write about something that's happened in your life.
When it's Anna Sweeney's turn to read, she pulls out her smartphone. Some writers dictate their stories on a phone or computer. Others type them up and have a voiceover software read it.
So I hope you guys can hear it.
The voiceover technology picks it up from there.
I have been blind, visually impaired all my life. I was a premature baby, and was 2 months early, and lost a lot of my sight due to getting too much oxygen.
Sweeney's story is a short memoir about her experience growing up blind. After it ends, the group's president, Robert Sollers, gets down to business.
For both you and Judy, writing about your personal experiences, there are a ton of places out there that want that stuff.
Writing in the Dark started in the spring, and the goal is not only to write, but to get published, too.
I just recently sort of came out of the writing closet. I've written poetry ever since I was in high school, but I never told anybody and I never showed it to anybody until I started with this group.
Tony Young just placed third in the National Federation of the Blind's writing contest for 2016.
When I started writing poetry, I didn't have the vision problem, or I wasn't aware that I had the vision problem. But then as my vision started getting worse and worse, I just kind of stopped writing.
She started again when this group showed up in a familiar space, the Arizona Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Robert Sollers says he never tried to look for a writing group outside the center, but starting one of his own with other blind writers seemed to make sense.
There's a lot of people out there who don't think that blind people can do these things. And I think the support that they're getting in our group, you know, with all of us being blind or visually impaired, we know what the struggles are for a blind person. We know how to help each other overcome them.
He wants the group to branch out and start submitting to publications outside of the blind and visually impaired community. That may mean extra barriers, like submission forms that don't work well with screen reading software. But at the same time, the mechanics of writing are easier than ever, thanks to new technology.
I at times felt like the sighted kids didn't want to play, and they didn't know how or what to say to their classmate who was blind.
Anna Sweeney says often what holds her back in life is someone thinking she can't do something, even if they mean well.
I live with my sister and her family. They have a washer and dryer, and I wanted to learn how to use it. And they weren't sure I would be able to use it or not. One day I just went over there and did it.
So the group isn't so much about figuring out how to write and publish as a person who is blind or visually impaired. It's more about writing and publishing, period. Something that some members don't think they'd be doing if they hadn't been involved in the blind and visually impaired community in the first place.
Oh, I know for a fact I wouldn't have, no.
I learned so much from the blind community. If you want to do something, you can.
If you want something in life, you have to be the one to go after what you want in life.
Serving.
Okay. The meeting ends with some chocolate cake, a celebration of Arizona officially recognizing October as Writing in the Dark Month. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.